Okay. Item number 9 is the Clackam Elk Herd Status and Management, and this is a briefing. Ted Klossing. And by the way, commissioners, we're looking at deferring the last item on the afternoon agenda if we run out of time. The wild system overview may get deferred. So, Sorry. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, thanks for having me. I'm Ted Klossing, Regional Wildlife Program Manager in the Yakima office. Thanks for making some time to talk about the Clackam Elk Herd. I think it's been about a year and a half since you had a briefing on an update on some of the research and some of the road modeling efforts. This is more a general topic, more all things Clackam, but just aside, I think after the last talk, I might switch my career and start working with whales because I didn't hear them mention road management one time in that period. So, we'll go away. So the objectives for today are to talk about the status of the herd and the recent management operations we're doing up there, some ongoing challenges that we seem to just follow the Clackam herd. We've got about 20,000 elk in the Region 3, and about a third of them are in Clackam. But I'm sure that it draws at least two-thirds of our attention for management and issues and controversy. So small herd, but does have quite a bit of action up there. And then also discuss the status of the Nanum Ridge to Columbia River Recreation Plan that's about at a midpoint right now. So the location of the herd, I think everybody probably knows, but officially it's the blue outlined or blue shaded area there, right in the center of the state. But even though that looks like a fairly large area, the two game management units down in the southeast corner, 328 and 329, actually have probably at least 80% of the elk down there, and in the winter, higher percentage of that. In the winter, they concentrate on fairly narrow strip down along the Columbia River. But the bounds of the herd in general are Interstate 90 from there to the north to the Wenatchee Valley, and from Blewett Pass east to the Columbia River. I think people are pretty well familiar, but I think the fact that it's in the center of the state, it has highways on all sides and easy access is part of its popularity. Some a little bit more about the area they inhabit. The core area is relatively open, not as open as, I mean, this is the eastern part, the winter range. This is characteristic of the eastern half of the range. But as you go higher in elevation farther west, it does become timbered, has open east side timber that's been heavily harvested. So it's still not a lot of hiding cover, but it is more moist and more cover than this. It has relatively high road densities and easy access. After I wrote easy access, I thought Director Anderson might not agree. I guess the better way to say it has lots of roads, but very few good roads. There's lots of miles of roads and very rocky, very rough, but you can get around and get to most parts of their range with motor vehicles. Unlike the Yakima, there's not much wilderness available to the elk. There's not much roadless area that they can escape into or go in for security. And currently it supports about over 25,000 hunter days of recreation per year. Still, it's really that popular. It was higher in the past. We've got some of the most restrictive general season regulations up there now trying to respond to some of the things we'll talk about today. So the herd plan was finalized in 2006, and these management objectives are from that. 4,500 elk, plus or minus about 2,500 is the goal. I mean 250, so it's somewhere in that 42 to 48 is the range we want the total herd to be in the, that's in the surveyed portion of the winter range, which is most of that eastern segment that's open and slopes down to the Columbia. And one of the hardest objectives, the one we haven't been able to attain yet, is the bull ratio. Just like in the Blues and in Yakima, we would like it to be over 12 bulls per 100 cows in the somewhere in the 12 to 20 range. Sort of the generic in all these plans is to improve habitat and reduce disturbance. Those, and that applies well to the Clockham. We've done quite a few things along those lines. Still more to do. And always also to try to minimize agricultural damage. That's, we've got some of the most liberal seasons around the herd to try to put pressure on those animals that are getting into the ag zone. More things we've done in the survey. The annual survey is in February or March, depending on the weather. It's a, we call it post-season, but it's actually post-season and post-winter. And it's all of the statistics we collect on bull ratios, calf ratios, total herd, and so the population trends are all collected at that one time in about a two-day set of helicopter surveys up and down through that winter range. And that one of the things that they've done to improve it lately was to go with an active GPS tracking system. They can carry a laptop, and they can actually see their route that they followed on, and the transect boundaries, and the sampling unit boundaries right on the map as they're going. So that helps eliminate, you know, if they say you're supposed to fly a transect every 200 meters, it's a lot more accurate now than it used to be with the old paper and maps. And now if you have a question about whether you've double counted a herd or missed a herd, that's really helped in the last 5 years or so. That's increased their certainty quite a bit in their survey efforts. And at the same time, it's a stratified random sample sightability model like we use in other parts of eastern Washington, developed in Idaho. But, you know, initially it would be stratified into the high management units or high density units, medium density units, and low. Then you would sample each of those at a different percentage, and then the model would do the expansion for you and tell you, and give you an estimate. But over time, and with the small size of that winter range, they just increasing sampling intensity over and over. Finally, they went to just about as efficient to fly the whole, every unit in there and not have to do the expansion. And that also has taken out some of the variability that we were seeing future year or former years. And then when they have really big herd, 200 to 500 is not uncommon out there. They will just, instead of trying to break it up and count them individually and classify them, they'll photograph the herd and then let the computer blow them up and count them. That's also taken out a lot of the guesswork. It doesn't work for picking out the bull. They still have to go in close and pick out the bulls and classify, but it does simplify the counting of estimating the large herds. Sorry, I've got the dry mouth going. And the other thing, at the same time, they decided that really uncertain when you try to classify calves out of a herd of 200 total elk. So they've started using that technique. They would wait until they'd see a band of 50 or 80 or something more manageable so that they could, after they counted the total, they could swing in close with the helicopter, break them, string them out, and classify the calves. So instead of trying to, you can't do that from the photos still, and they're not trying to do it with the big herds, but again, calf discriminating between yearlings and calves has always been one of the most difficult parts and most uncertain parts of the technique. So the trend over the last 10, 12 years has been shown there. The goal is in the pink bar. The most of this decade we've been below objective. We've been struggling to get up. We restricted general season opportunity in the primary hunting areas because we had a lot of harvest on the fringes and the ag conflict areas. And just in the last 5 or 6 years, the population has started to respond to that. Now we're above objective, and they're ahead of us a little bit. So we're starting to get back into general season opportunities. We added about 120 permits last fall, and I think it's going to be 370 or so this fall, and if the trends continue, I expect we might be able to get another 300 or 400, because we need to, you know, level that off. It's nice that they're productive, and it's nice that they're above objective for a change, but we can't let them go too far in that direction. And this is the results of that calf ratio count at the same time. Like I say, there's a lot of skepticism. Even the bios aren't that certain about, you know, their call in each and every case. We've always thought we were conservative, because if they know it's a difficult call between calves and yearlings when you're going by at 40 miles an hour in a helicopter, then, you know, they've de-emphasized, or they've always been real conservative, saying, I'm sure that one is a calf, I'm not sure about some of the others. So hard to test that, but for the last 4 years, we had the Clockham Elk study was also going on, where we actually handled about 150 cows during that period of time. 134 were actually tested this way. So they were in December, and this is the lactation rate. So that indicates that at least 33% of those cows in December still had calves. That's considerably higher than what we were seeing the following spring for calf ratios. You'd assume they're going to lose a few. Things will happen between December and March, but I think that somewhere between that 33 figure and the 24 is probably more realistic through that technique. It really, we don't rely on it too much, because really what is most important of that survey is the population trend itself. No matter how many they have in March, if they're not there the next following March, then they're not part of the management, something you can manage. And from the same survey technique, the bull ratio is shown here. The goal is 12 to 20, actually, so the line indicates that. We've been chronically below that, haven't attained it. Even that 1 year that it shows we went way over it, that's during the period when the sampling was partial or random samples, and we think that was probably a situation where we hit a good group of elk in a unit that had low density, and the model said, oh, great, all these low density units have 10 bulls, and so we don't think that's real egg. You would want to smooth those out, and you'd find them all probably get up around 10 bulls per 100 or so, which is where we are now. It's the best we've done in the last 10 years or so. In the, you can see 94 is where the spike only first came into effect, and that was all of eastern Washington, well, the Blues and Yakima and Clockham. And it had a positive effect for a few years. Went from just a few bulls per 100 up to 10 or so. Then it kind of trailed off. And in 2009, we instituted the, I'm sure you remember it well, the true spike only management, which is even more restrictive. And again, we think we're seeing an upward trend from that. We think that's working as expected, at least for the younger age classes. And this just kind of shows the example. Before 94, it was any bull with any antler conformation. After 94, there could be a spike on one side, maybe a 2-point or a 3-point or so on the other. And then after 09, there had to be a clean, pure spike on both sides. And the Clockham is the only place that I'm aware of where that would work very well. In the Yakima, we don't really see very many of these branched yearlings. Clockham produces 15 or 20% of the yearlings are branched, so that gave us another tool that seems to have, not real popular to the public, wasn't initially, and probably still isn't, but it seems to really have helped with our recruitment. And some of that's shown here. So for the first part of this period, you can see the average is running around. So this is harvest, 82% or so harvested their first fall, which means you're only getting about 18% survival. And then when we switched to true spike only, it went to about 35% survival or 65% harvest. And down below you can see that under the traditional spike only management, when you had all the herds managed the same, we got about 40% survival in the Blues, 30% survival in Yakima, and only that 18% in the Clockham. So that goes back to the vulnerability of lots of roads, not much timber, lots of open ground, highly popular with the public. And so going to true spike only got us into the realm of somewhere between the Blue Mountains recruitment and the Yakima recruitment, which was the goal. This is another way to look at it that shows the yearling bull or survival, you know, past season in the red and the adult bulls. So again, in post-winter, this is what the population looks like. So in 2009, we didn't get much of a, or the following year, we didn't get much of a response after that first year of true spike only management. We think we had a lot of buyer resistance, had a lot of people that, some people knowingly and some unknowingly took bulls that weren't supposed to be taken, and some were left and some were taken out. But the years after that, we've had pretty good survival, 120 to 160 yearlings on the winter range after the season. And last year was the first that was actually reflected in this bottom bar of adult bulls, 227. You know, they weren't really showing up on the winter range as older age animals, but they have started to now for the first time. We're hoping that trend continues too. So I think the topic of about a year and a half ago was the zone of influence road influence map or modeling process that William presented. I've only got a couple of slides here just to remind people, but that was basically he mapped out all the roads and trails and attributed their whether they're opened or closed or what, you know, what kind of traffic they got, and the trails had one kind of a buffer zone, open roads had another. I think on average he applied about 1,000 foot or 1,000 meter buffer on roads and open terrain like this. That kind of illustrates what it would do, how it treats an individual road, but when you apply it to the whole range of the elk, of the Clackam elk, you see that road after road after road, they interact with each other, and so the zone of influence is a pretty high percentage of, especially since most of the elk are in 328 and 329, there aren't very many places down there that you can get more than 1,000, or get where you don't see or hear roads because you're farther away than 1,000 meters. 249 is the Alpine Lakes Wilderness. It's really nice, but low density, not much disturbance, but the elk don't go up there much. There's only a few that get that far west. So to try to fill in the blanks, you know, we had the Clackam elk study from 08 to about 2012. That's when we collared the cows, and we have a lot of data from that. It took 3 years to collect it. It might take 3 years to analyze it all. We had 400,000 data points, I think, but we didn't do any work with bulls, and there's still this question about, so okay, now we've got bulls, young bulls surviving through the hunting season. They're not showing up on the winter range. And we've always had people saying, well, we got way more bulls than you know about because you're not flying the areas of where they winter. And there, we know a few clusters out in the trees and things where you couldn't see them with a helicopter anyway. So we're starting this August a bull phase of the Clackam study, which would probably also be about 3 years, collar older animals in the winter when we know where some of them are at, and also during the breeding season. That's the one time that they do come out, mingle with the cows, of course, and if you trap them, collar them during August, then wherever they go the next winter, we're hoping to be able to identify those non-traditional winter ranges, maybe figure out how and when they segregate from the larger herd, and hopefully find a way to track their numbers over time. This has been a topic or question for the whole time I've been in that position, and it happens with every herd. I'm sure it happens in the Yakima and the Blue Mountains, but in the Clackam it seems to be a larger component of the bull population that does this. Might be the only way they found to survive is get away from those roads and those the reserve. So the agricultural damage situation is basically restricted to the Kittitas Valley and the Wenatchee Valley. We've got damage units designed that sort of follow the edge of the agriculture, and we've got almost 6 month open seasons for master hunters in the Fairview, especially. That's the one I'm most familiar with. So from August 1st until February, if they're caught down in the ag zone or right next to the ag zone, master hunters can take the antlerless elk from there. They part of it's to harvest a few, but most of it is to harass and haze the others that are with them. The smartest of the smart over here in Spring Creek and Caribou Creek, they have reserves on private property where people don't want them to be hunted or harassed, and they're smart enough to come out at night, go head toward the irrigated ag, and then sneak back in before daylight in the morning. So we've still got problems. We've got things like volunteers out there doing night guard duty, try to keep them from coming in after dark, and things. It's way better situation and more tolerance from the landowners since we've had the conflict specialists in the last 6 years, and they work more closely with those people than we were able to before. And the other damage areas are probably half a dozen of them up here in the orchards above the Wenatchee River, and then we've got traditional problems down and smaller scale problems down in the Tianaway too, depending on crop patterns and how tolerant. Another situation where some neighbors feed them in the winter and other neighbors get damaged, and very hard to deal with those. But again, with a conflict specialist able to make immediate contact and work with those people, it's been getting better over time. So this the NAM Ridge to Columbia River Recreation Plan has kind of evolved. It started a little over a year ago. The Department of Natural Resources, it was their project, and they were just going to do basically the NAM Ridge State or NAM State Forest, which is the western half of this planning area. And after we looked at it and talked for a few months, we decided we should go in together as equal partners, and the boundary expanded. So now we've gone through this pre-planning stage. We selected a public committee of about 15 members, really good representatives, about half from Wenatchee side and about half from the Kittitas Valley, a few from other locations, but that's the general makeup. They spent about 6 months going through the land suitability part of it, where they mapped biological resources and archaeological and unstable slopes and all those types of things, did all the GIS layers that they could combine. And then through the committee and through a series of, I think, four open houses so far, they've been collecting information from folks about, you know, how do you recreate out there now? What do you want it to be like in the future? So we're about to the red line there, moving into the development of alternatives over the next 3 or 4 months, and then it'll be analyzed through CEPA, more public meetings, and sort of a little bit of a tiger by the tail. When the first alternative came out, or the first plan came out, it was going to be about half as large, and we were going to be maybe 15% of the acreage was Department of Fish and Wildlife. We would have been a bit player, but since we joined forces, it's a big deal. This map shows that the Department of Natural Resources has been doing this for about 10 years, I think. They've got a bunch of them in western Washington. They've only got one that's been completed on the east side down in the Attanum State Forest. But none of those are in this scale. Most of those are 40 to, you know, maybe 90,000 acres. This new one is 230,000 acres and almost equally divided between the two agencies. This is the map of the planning area. Initially, the line would have come about down through here, and it would have been, like I say, the NAM Basin and a little bit of our ownership. I wouldn't take this ownership map to the bank because we own more than, it's more checkerboarded up here in the north half. This may have been something that was in part of the land exchange. But so when we joined forces, we included everything over to the Columbia River. Now it's all the Department of Fish and Wildlife and DNR land between the forest and the river. And there are a lot of recreational pursuits out there. I described a little the land suitability phase that we have spent most of our time on. We, as an agency, provided most of the biological, you know, several aspects of elk biology, the winter range, calving areas, late summer forage, of course all the raptor nests and bighorn sheep and things in that, and then they had their geologists work on that end of it. And management is everything from easements and cell towers and grazing leases and different kinds of things. So the idea was to collect them all independently and then put them together with GIS so that the committee could work. and they've combined them into sort of seasonal composites, and it scares people when they see the map because it has a lot of, you know, color means some kind of constraint or concern. And you don't want people to make the leap that they can't do anything there. There's a line that just means something to worry about. So if you're going to build a campground or a trailhead or a trail, then you need to look at that suitability and see what the issues are there, what the resources are that need to be worked around. I don't think we've totally made that transition with the public or the committee yet. First impression when you see these is, well, there's, if it's all purple, they can't do anything, when that's not the case. But that'll take quite a bit more explaining, I think, to get through, and I think we might have to work through a few examples. But this is the winter suitability. Most of this light purple is the winter range for the Clockamelk. And some of the low elevation areas have other issues. I don't even know what all the issues are at this scale. It's not meant to be used at this scale, but if you zoomed in on a specific parcel to look at a campground or a trailhead, a lot of that would fall away, and you'd have a clearer understanding of what kind of resources need to be dealt with. For us on this winter range side of things, the goal we focused on is this southern third of the winter range down here. We've had a temporary vehicle access restriction out there for the last 6 years. That goes from February, March, and April. There's just this internal system of roads is not open during that period of time. This boundary road, Quilmian Ridge Road up here, is, and then Vantage Highway is the southern boundary. That's about 40,000 acres, and it's about a third or almost a half of the wintering elk population. It's an area that you can get easy access from the pavement. We have good car counter data that shows spring activity out there was getting extreme 10 years or so ago. People were going out there as much or more during that spring period as they do during hunting season. So, you know, for a disturbance on the winter range, that was getting to be a serious consideration. But as you probably noticed, it's not been popular, and it's not been decided what to do with it permanently. So now it's a part of this recreation plan in the bigger arena with more give and take, you know, maybe that kind of a thing. We're hoping that kind of a thing can be discussed in there and just, you know, have people understand the justification better than they have when it's standalone. And this is just an example of the summer suitability. It looks a lot the same, but it's for different reasons. They have a plant ecologist. Most of this light purple pinkish color is now because it's also shrub step. It's winter range when the elk are there. It's shrub step other times. And then under there you can see some of the circles. Those are probably golden eagle nests or raptor nests of one kind or another. Bighorn sheep along the side here. And then a lot of this real bright color is geologic information, I think. Steep and unstable slopes. We saw some of those on our trip too. So on this, I guess the elk part of this, it's really hard to see. The cross-hatching in blue is the calving area for about 50% of the Clockam herd, from the Clockam elk study. That's where they spend June primarily. There's a little bit of it down here. And then also in there in the blue shade is those high elevation late summer forage areas. It's about 6,000 feet, and it's the last place for the snow to leave. And there's some meadows and flatter ground. And that type of forage that time of year is really important to the elk and how the condition that they go into the fall. So that's the area we want to focus. If we get, you know, make progress down here in the winter, this area is our focus in the summer and the fall. Again, and also with the Clockam Reserve, Coffin Reserve is right in the center. That's no trespassing any time of the year, basically. So it attracts a lot of elk and a lot of hunters around the edges. So our focus in this planning effort is to think of that as sort of a donut. If that's the elk protection area, it'd be nice to have some lower road densities, at least seasonally, probably September through November or September into November, around there, so that the elk bull vulnerability and elk vulnerability can be influenced, and maybe if we got enough protection, maybe we wouldn't have to have true spike only management anymore, if we could give the bulls a breather. And the only other topic is, I don't know how many people got questions about the fires from last year. We thought it was a big fire. Table Mountain Fire was down here in the summertime. It burned mostly sort of between Lookout Mountain and off toward Ellensburg. Mostly low elevation, private land, a little bit of DNR in there. And you can see the underlying data points are that cow elk relocations from the Clockham Elk Study. So it shows that they're not using that area specifically, and it doesn't have very many elk in it at all. They've got some that move in from the Tiana way up here. But it does have up to 1,000 spring deer in the springtime, spring green up. So, you know, we were concerned initially that maybe we'd have hungry deer in the winter, but they didn't move in there until spring. So on balance, I think that one will probably improve forage and might be fine for the deer, and it won't influence very many elk. This was the Table Mountain Complex, which was in September. High elevation, mostly Forest Service, but it's a lot of closed canopy lodgepole pine, or it was. And even though you can see the elk used it in there, it didn't have a lot of forage. So now, if anything, since that one's high elevation and you know, it's off to the west a little bit of the area we've been talking about so far, but we expect that'll increase forage conditions. And it will decrease hiding cover for a while, but if anybody's watched those burns after a couple of years, they get so brushy and there's so much downfall in there, I think that will also provide food and some security on the Forest Service part of that property. So I don't know if anybody, I mean, that was a big topic in the fall, how is this going to influence my hunting, and as it chased all those elk down to the farmland and things. I'm thinking both together, I think it's going to be a plus. Not the way you want to do forest health management, but not too bad in this case, I think, for elk. So I covered sort of from soup to nuts there. Must have created some questions.
Soup to nuts, okay. Any questions? Thank you. Commissioner Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a whole bunch, but I'll limit it down a little bit. You mentioned the early on in your talk about the Clockham Elk Study, and you showed a slide or two that showed the influence of the road on habitat and so forth, and some of the game management units were almost completely red. With that information, what bearing will that have on potential road closures?
We're trying to use it in that recreation planning effort, because now we've got, you know, some quality time with people to explain things. But I think the best thing about it is, as we, in the next few months, as we develop, or anybody develops alternatives, I think you can use that analysis to say, well, you know, closing that road doesn't accomplish anything, because there's two roads right next to it that overlap the zone of influence. But if you close that one that goes off by itself out into some basin, that might trim off the zone of influence. So those kinds of things, I think we can do the what if. It's pretty easy for them, you know, not looking at a whole GMU, you're not going to get very far. But with the committee, if somebody has a plan, we can say, well, this is what it will or won't do probably for elk. So we're hoping to, and I think it's too much to lay it out there and say the whole area is highly eroded and the elk won't like it. But if you could do it case by case, I think we can make some progress there.
Sounds to me like that study would be a good scientific base to make those kind of decisions on which roads could possibly be eliminated, prove habitat, but yet still allow access into the area.
There was a time when road management was fairly routine, and early in my career we did lots of miles of it, but it's anything but routine yet now. So I think hopefully this committee and this process, where we can all delve into the details more and you know, it has to be for more than one objective. Maybe a place where you close a road becomes a good trail or some other use. We're hoping there'll be allies as this process plays out some more.
The planning, the recreational planning committee there, I think that's a good way to do it, to draw all the viewpoints in and see what you can come up with. However, Department land, I think, has the number one goal of producing fish and wildlife. and maintaining high-quality habitat. And recreation, particularly at certain times of the year, certain types of recreation is not very compatible with high-quality habitat and the use of that habitat by wildlife. It seems to me like the department will have to address that sooner or later, particularly in an area like this that's really open, has high use of probably a lot of things that are not necessarily wildlife-oriented. Is that concept being accepted or discussed by this committee?
It's all been discussed. Nothing's really been accepted because this whole first year we've abstained from putting alternatives on maps just so that people would understand the resources and the process and the give and take and sort of understand what everybody else wants and needs before. Because, you know, I think if you start putting lines on the map too early, that becomes the issue versus the process and the learning. But yeah, I think I glossed over that ownership. You mentioned that, you know, so on the winter range closure down here, it's primarily Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the whole winter range is heavy to our ownership now. DNR is still in there to a certain extent, but we've got grazing leases on that. But just the opposite up around the reserve and the areas that we want to try to reduce densities during the hunting season to influence bull survival, that's mostly DNR, and we're going to be all we can do is request, I think, there. And that's what this process, I think, will help us do, too, is explain and compromise or negotiate.
Two more points. You mentioned damage in this closure that is in the Whiskey Dick area, basically. It's shown on that map. I think that's good that it provides a place without disturbance during a period of time when the animals may want to come onto ag land. If they're chased off, they at least have a place to go that isn't where there's no disturbance. But has there been any consideration of doing specific habitat improvement on sites like that might make it more attractive for elk that would draw them onto those areas and other places where there's damage too, particularly on the north end?
Probably less of that discussion on the south end there because it's about the most rocky, hard to manage rangeland. Just a little bit further to the west and north, though, we did the CRM, which is partly designed to change the forage, utilize it early so that maybe it would be more attractive to elk. But we do have old ag fields like you probably remember up in a little bit more in the center of the winter range, that those have been put back into CRP and pretty high quality forage there now. One thing that we probably could consider, and we never have, is range fertilization. Because you don't need to work the ground that way, you could fly it on. But we haven't gotten to that.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping that you guys would consider, to keep from having to kill so many animals on from a damage standpoint, concentrate more on drawing them off. My only other point is with the relative concentration of elk in this area, it's actually a fairly small area relative to other elk areas. Do you have any feeling for how wolves may impact that area? And you've got so much information on the elk use of this that it seems to me like you'd have a really good opportunity to look at how wolves may affect that population.
Yeah, they haven't been there that long, and we haven't done that yet. But, you know, the Tanaway, so the Tanaway pack is pretty really close to where this red dot is over here, maybe a little bit north. They've been there several years. They haven't ventured over in any documented way over into the Clockham itself, but they're obviously getting the deer and the elk that are migrating to and from. And now the new Wenatchee pack is, my understanding, it's about here. So yeah, I think they're finding the elk, and they're obviously going to be making use of them if they survive, you know, if they persist in those two areas. But as far as collaring animals or whatever, trying to monitor the amount of use, we haven't discussed that either. But if two packs right in the vicinity, that might be something that could be looked at.
Thank you, Ted.
Commissioner Caney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The primary opposition to the road closure from the sportsmen's groups in Ellensburg Is that, on the winter road closure, is that primarily shed hunters, snowmobilers? What's the main thought there?
Not snowmobilers, because it's pretty, I mean, it does get some snow cover, but it's not reliable, and it, you know, it doesn't stay on the ridgetops and things. So it's mostly, I think when we started documenting those really high spring use levels, early 2000s, it was shed hunting. It was after we had started to have a few bulls in the Clockham, but part of it is, and what they tell us is it's cabin fever, it's going to see the flowers. It's one of the few places you can get easy motorized access to the shrub step. A lot of the roads are snowed in or blocked in by other ways. Here you got a paved road that leads you right to it. And I think it's every combination of things, but then there's also some people just don't want to see anything closed, because a lot has been closed for other purposes all over the place. So,
because I've only been out there once, and it was 3 weeks after that I had back surgery, so I can relate to what Phil went through. I'm not sure. And if it's four-wheelers, there's a lot of four-wheelers used to be used that area as well.
Yeah, and that's really the most efficient way to move around out there, because you are able to get a little speed with those, and you know, not rock crawling like we had to do.
Okay, other comments, questions? Interesting, very interesting. Director Anderson?
Add a couple things, maybe first with a question. In the NANM process and adding, you know, this big additional landscape, is there going to be additional time allotted to the process itself? Because of, it seems to me there's an increased level of complexity and issues that will need to be addressed, and it would take, as well as additional stakeholders perhaps, that would be participating.
Yeah, it happened early enough. You know, the committee was partially formed but not fully formed when we made the decision to go in together, so the committee was increased in size, and I think we were careful to get sports clubs and Rocky Mountain Elk and things like that in it. And they really did already expand the boundary. I think initially, it might not have been real, but you know, the plan was to have it done by this fall, and now it goes into 2014. I think it may end up having to go farther into 2014. Nobody really knows. Once you start, you know, once it gets so far that you put it into SEPA, then it'll be depend on how people receive the SEPA document and all those things. But yeah, they've almost doubled the allotted time for that, and they did it. I keep saying they, but we're just an equal partner and have been since last summer. But we've got a bigger committee and a little bit different committee because of that.
And then just a couple more. The controversy around the winter closure in the Whiskey Dick area is permeating well beyond that closure itself, and I mean, we're being accused of all kinds of things as a result of people interpreting or assuming what that winter closure is in place for, what, you know, whether we have alternative motives and all that sort of thing. I think this was the fourth year that was in place. Is that
right? I think it was six.
Six?
Oh, eight.
Originally, it was, I think, I'm not sure if we use the term pilot, but it was a pilot kind of project to see whether or not that winter closure would have an impact in terms of reducing adverse impacts with elk on ag lands. And are we at a point where we have collected enough data, we have looked at trends relative to crop damage, where those animals are residing during the winter, where we can conclude whether or not that area is accomplishing the objective?
Yeah, that's probably one of the problems. I don't know if we had clear enough objectives. You know, anytime you call it a pilot, then people's assumptions, some assume that when at the end of the second year it's gone. Other people assume that if it's working, it continues. We've kind of had closure creep, I think. Partly because this Clockham Elk study got started a year later than we expected, so we extended the closure for that to get the data, and then this recreation plan came along, and we thought, gee, it really makes sense to include that in the recreation planning because it's a quarter of the area or whatever, and we've got the data from the study. But it's sort of mixed, too. The first, like 2009, they did exactly what we wanted. They stayed out there until about end of April, and then they went on their way. Since then, some of them have moved early, some have moved later, and the study documented there's a lot of back and forth. Like Commissioner Perry was saying, when they get disturbed, they go out. Maybe when they get disturbed on that side, they can come back. A good example was this year in February or so, about 1,500 elk were being observed over in Park Creek on the, near the ag zone and in the ag zone, and the common perception was, well, it's not working because they're over here. So we went out and did a secondary flight in the winter range, and there were still 1,700 in the winter range, in that portion of the winter range. So it's sort of working. It's working for some of the elk some of the time, but to say that it solved the problems in the Park Creek area 100%, no, I didn't do that.
And just, I mean, I think it's, I'm really, I'm happy that we're engaged in this process and that it's expanded and it's more of a comprehensive look at the landscape there in terms of a use analysis and weighing different values and from wildlife conservation to recreational activities. We, as I mentioned in my director's report, Nate and I went over and met with the Kittitas Field and Stream, a couple of folks from representing that organization, and this is, I don't know if it's their number one issue, but if you throw Tukaisin and Stray Gulch in this, it's right up there. And there is no, this is a really difficult issue, and there are bunch of competing perspectives and views, and so it would be, I think it will be important for you to keep the commission informed as to how this process is going along, and we should think about scheduling, even if it's a half hour on future agendas, to get an update on this, because I mean we have people across the street that are very, very interested in this, very focused on what happens in Kittitas County, having different perspectives on what degree the residents of Kittitas County should drive the decision versus, you know, to what extent should they, should their perspectives weigh heavier in the decision or not. So just keeping track of this and not waiting until next spring or late winter to hear the results, because I can almost guarantee you that no matter how good this process is and whatever conclusions or recommendations they come up with, there are going to be some strong feelings perhaps against whatever those might be, and we need to be kept in the loop along the way so that we're ready for that conversation and ultimate decision making when we get there.
Yeah, the when we first started that process, we were getting input from, I'm not sure where I lost that map, from others. Another club said close the whole winter range from just south of Wenatchee all the way down to the Vantage Highway, treat the whole area the same. It would have been nearly three times as big as the one we settled on. And others said, well, if you're going to close it to vehicles, close it to foot traffic too. And we were trying to do the very minimum we thought we could do and still get at the problem. So I think the Wenatchee Club was disappointed we didn't do more. So, but anyway, we are where we are, and we'll try to keep everybody informed as we go along.
Thank you. Good job. Tough issue.